good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cedarstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. The second and third segment today, yes, I am pleased to have my conversation with James Corbett. It was previously recorded, and a lot of great information, particularly what's going on with Nissan. That was in the headline news today, and so he's great to report on it, but let's get to the market report today. This is the last trading day of November. It is the 30th of November, 2018. And I'm going to try to get through this 20-minute segment without coughing in your ears, ladies and gentlemen. I never thought to have Butch do the 20 minutes or Dave Allen to do the 20 minutes. And that's how dedicated I am, ladies and gentlemen. So please, please forgive me for my little coughs if it occurs. I will try to do the mind over matter. All right. I was taught that a very long time ago. All your fears, it's mind over matter. So we'll see if that works. I'm not so sure it's going to, but we'll see. Gold today, down 230, 1222.60. Silver down 14 at $14.25. Platinum down 21 at 802. Palladium down 8, 1181. I don't know why platinum was down so big. I mean, that was almost 3%. And I mean, it's just, you know, I think palladium, I mean, it's got to be all of a Russian play along with rhodium. And it seems like the two are going, you know, sort of hand in hand, palladium and rhodium. We'll see how high. I mean, I watched rhodium go from 400 to 10,000 back in the early 2000s. It was so very exciting, and I think we'll eventually, I don't know when, but eventually, and I think soon, we're going to see the same thing happen with gold. We're going to see gold hanging around these levels, and the next thing is going to take off. And but that's not going to happen probably until government begins to default on the debt. We know we have debt that's too great to be paid. And I can't say that President Trump isn't trying. He certainly is. He's certainly making waves. And I do like the way he stands up to a lot of these other countries. If anything positive, I do like him standing up. But then again, but we have crude oil today. We have down 85 cents at 50.60. USDX was up 0.47 at 97.25. Paper markets today, you know, they had a big turnaround after there was, you know, pretty much a consensus that President Trump and China is going to, and China's President Xi is going to at least walk away from this G20 summit with some sort of open discussion to ease these tensions on the trade spat that they're having. So once that was pretty much agreed to today, then it'll be a successful dinner engagement tomorrow. The Dow turned around and it was up 195 points at 25,533. The NASDAQ was up 57 at 7330, and the S&P was up 22 at 2759. 10-year yield is hovering around that 3%, 3.01. That was down a little bit. Confidence is beginning to come back into the market. The fear and greed index hovering at 23, certainly off the lows of 4, 5, and 6 that we were talking about just a couple of weeks ago. Bitcoin had, you know, more pressure on it. It dipped below 4,000 once again today. And I did have something. There was in Texas, there was a federal prosecutors said they have arrested a Dallas-based cryptocurrency CEO on charges of securities and wire fraud, adding that he allegedly defrauded investors to the tune of $4 million. Now, $4 million isn't a whole lot of money anymore in today's world, except to those who, you know, are attached to those $4 million. Jared Rice Sr. He's only 30. claimed to run something called Arise Bank, and it is related purported to the cryptocurrency Arise coin. The new criminal charges are on top of a complaint brought by the SEC earlier this year in January, around the same time that the Texas Department of Banking issued a cease and desist order. Yes, the state and federal authorities got involved in late January and claimed that Arise Bank was the world's first decentralized banking platform and would offer traditional FDIC-insured accounts along with debit and credit cards. In actuality, Arise Bank had not been authorized to conduct banking in Texas, was not FDIC-insured, did not have any sort of partnership with Visa. And remember, folks, if it's on the internet, it doesn't mean that it's true. Not everything on the internet is true. It always takes me back to that one commercial of that girl who's talking to her neighbor, and I guess she's got this date that she got online dating and so forth, and you know, he comes up and he's looking like a bum, you know, not dressed very nice, sloppy, very sloppily dressed, and he's from France, you know. Anyway, it's just, if you don't know the commercial, you probably don't can't relate to what I'm telling you, but it is kind of funny. So not everything on the internet is true. However, we do know that there was a earthquake today, a 7.0 magnitude earthquake in the state of Alaska this morning, and sent a lot of people running into the streets. I guess it was about 5 miles north of Anchorage. There were no injuries. They did issue a tsunami warning for the Cook Inlet and the Southern Kenai Peninsula shortly after the earthquake, but later canceled it. It was funny. There was this one guy said he was alone at home. He was soaking in the bathtub when the earthquake hit. He said the quake created a powerful back and forth sloshing in the bathtub, and before he knew it, he'd been thrown out of the tub by the force of the waves. I can't imagine being tossed out of a bathtub. Maybe, I suppose. I mean, you know, maybe if you weigh 20 pounds, you know, he must be a very small gentleman and doesn't weigh very much and so forth. I just can't imagine being thrown out of the tub by the force of the waves, but I guess it's possible. I mean, you think you'd at least hold on to the edge of the tub to keep that from happening, but so it's either a very deep tub or a very low tub. I don't know, but it's interesting that Alaska averages about 40,000 earthquakes per year. 40,000, with more large quakes than the other 49 states combined. And on March 27th, 1964, Alaska was hit by a magnitude 9.2 earthquake, and of course that was the strongest recorded in U.S. history. And that one was about 75 miles east of Anchorage, and there were 130 lives lost due to the tsunami it had triggered. So didn't happen today, and I hope it doesn't happen again. And we have a lot of clients in Alaska, so I hope they are all safe. You know, and people say, well, Melanie, you have clients everywhere, it seems. And we do. You know, so when things happen in these states, I do think of my customers, and I do hope they are all safe. We have customers in all the states, and we do have quite a few in Alaska. So, and I love Alaska. I think Alaska's probably one of the few. Idaho was very similar. It was when I went to Alaska, and I was there a couple times, it was just one of those places where I just felt at home. You know, it really is a great place to be and a great place to visit. I don't think I'd want to be in the winter. Of course, we were there in the summer. I know I don't want to be there in the winter, but beautiful, absolutely beautiful. And there's such a peace. And I think that's, you know, when you get out to the country, to the mountains, and, you know, that's what it gives you, just this feeling of, you know, anyway, that's me. That's me, and I hope everybody else thinks the same way. Anyway, U.S. consumer spending increased by the most in 7 months in October. Of course, you have the underlying price pressure slowed with the inflation measure tracked by the Federal Reserve. The strong consumer spending reported by the Commerce Department yesterday keeps the U.S. Central Bank on track to raise rates next month for the fourth time this year. As we know, consumer spending, which accounts for more than two-thirds of U.S. economic activity, jumped 0.6% last month. But the data for September was revised down to show that spending rose only 0.2% instead of the previously reported 0.4%. GM, of course, is in the news. Mary Barra, she's going to meet with U.S. lawmakers over these job cuts. And you know, we all know that, you know, this GM has come under this harsh criticism. So she's going to meet with lawmakers from Michigan and Ohio, where GM plans to shutter the three plants, as well as some senior leaders in Congress. And she's been calling on lawmakers this week to explain the decision to end production. And the Cruise compact car will be discontinued in the U.S. market in 2019. Although GM may continue building it in Mexico for other markets. And speaking of Mexico, President Trump and the leaders of Canada and Mexico signed a revision of the quarter century old North American Free Trade Agreement early this morning. I saw the signing when they were doing it. I was watching it on television. And there were certainly some tensions there with Trudeau. It was kind of interesting to watch. But what's interesting about this is we're not sure the new Congress is going to approve the pact. So even though everybody was all this hoopla on signing the deal, with Democrats taking control of the House in January, it still remains uncertain whether this is going to get passed. President Trump, he says he didn't expect much of a problem. What else is he going to say? Democrats, they did signal that they weren't going to support the deal without additional protection for workers, though it calls for some more safeguards than the agreement would replace. The revised pact, which comes after a long, difficult negotiation, won't replace NAFTA until it has been approved by the legislatures of all three countries. So, I mean, we've gotten this far. I'm assuming there isn't going to be anything that wouldn't get the final deal done. But it ain't over until it's over. And so it isn't passed until it's passed. And I didn't know. I know they were in a hurry to get this done prior to the new president of Obrador, and he's being inaugurated tomorrow. What I find interesting is that Ivanka and VP Pence is leaving the G20 meeting to go to Mexico for the inauguration of the new Mexican president. I don't know if this is commonplace. I tried to get some information to see how often we send officials, particularly those as high as Vice President Pence and Trump's advisor, Ivanka, his daughter, to go to various inaugurations of other countries' presidents. This might be a very common thing. I never really thought about it before, but I found this to be interesting. So the president isn't going to be attending, of course. he's also sending Energy Secretary Rick Perry. And this is all to signal the importance the borders play in relations between Mexico and the U.S. Homeland Security Secretary Kirsten Nielsen, I guess, will also be heading out. On Monday, Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law and advisor, is heading to Mexico City. He'll arrive. In fact, prior to the signing this morning, he received Mexico's prestigious Order of the Aztec Eagle. Now, this is the highest honor that Mexico bestows upon foreigners. And of course, this is for his work on crafting the USMCA deal. And so, you know, the decision to give him the award prompted some controversy because despite his achievements on trade, the border remains a central issue and potential challenge for the incoming Mexican president. So I find that all interesting. Not a lot of talk on that. Of course, all mainstream media, all they're talking about is Cohen, and this, and that. You know, they can't get another breath of anything else. But I find this interesting, and we'll have to see how it all plays out. United Auto Workers Union said General Motors' decision to idle plants in U.S. and Canada shows the new trade deal between the United States, Canada, and Mexico just isn't strong enough to stop the flow of jobs across the Mexican border. The United Auto Workers said today that the GM is basically thumbing its nose at the trade deal. This agreement between these three countries is meant to replace the 24-year-old North American Free Trade Agreement. And the UAW President Gary Jones says, we are hopeful that this new agreement would rein in the corporate greed that has bled manufacturing in the United States. Unfortunately, as GM's idling of plants, the new NAFTA as it stands now is just not strong enough to protect American workers. So I've read that, you know, this new agreement is, you know, 85-90% the same as it was, that there isn't a whole lot of new change. So we will have to wait and see what the Democrats will do come January. So this agreement doesn't get the backing by the UAW, so we'll have to see how this plays out. Corporations like GM have revealed time and time again that they will continue to play by their own rules at the expense of workers, even after raking in record profits. Our elected leaders owe it to the working families of the United States to go back to the table and make this stronger, tighter, and enforceable. So we'll have to see, you know, how this has all plays out. The future looks bleak through the eyes of the workers at the factories that GM plans to idle, the UAW said. And this new measure has failed to stop the flow of work from the U.S. to Mexico, where labor is cheaper because workers are exploited. Kids' clothing retailer Gymboree, they're weighing about closing half of its stores, closing more than half of its approximately 900 stores. The move would be a setback for Gymboree after it emerged from bankruptcy last year. It was one of the few brick-and-mortar retailers that managed to escape liquidation. Well, we're going to be heading into a break here in just a few minutes. I just want to remind you, give us a call at 1-800-375-4188. When we get back, James Corbett will be here. It's a very interesting two-segment conversation with James, which I enjoy so much. Please stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at DGScoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and I'm pleased to welcome back to the program James Corbett. And, of course, James is the founder and editor of the Corbett Report that was started in 2007 and became the editorial writer for the International Forecaster in 2012. And, of course, the International Forecaster was created by our good friend and economic analyst Bob Chapman. And you can visit the website for James, thecorbettreport.com, and you can also request a complimentary copy of the International Forecaster by going to their website, theinternationalforecaster.com. Hello, James, and it's always great to spend this hour with you.
It's great to be back. Thank you for having me.
There's a lot of things we're going to talk about, and I hesitate to ask you if you would like to start the program off with something that's on your mind that you'd like to share with the listeners before we get into some of the questions I like to ask you. And when I ask you that, you always start on my topic. So
that's why I was wondering, why do you hesitate to ask? Oh, I see. You don't want me to step on your toes. You'll be happy to know that tonight I am a complete blank slate because I have just finished writing part three of my World War One documentary, which means I can finally now turn back to the news and actually find out what's going on in the world. So I've been about out of the loop lately and don't really have a lot to comment on. So well, fire your best at me.
Oh, so you're putting it all in my lap, are you not? Well, okay, well, let's start with your documentary. I was going to talk about it a little later on in the segment of the program, but we talked about the last time you were on Financial Survival. We talked about part one of the of your documentary, and it really is an insightful, fascinating. It provides your viewpoints on the real events that led to the war that killed at least 9 million soldiers and 7 million civilians. Dave Allen told me today he finished part two of your program last evening, and he thinks that you created a series that should be a part of any high school civics or social studies curriculum. And he's in part two, which you titled The American Front, starts on May 7th in 1915, and you talked about a conversation at Buckingham Palace between Colonel Edward Mandell House and King George V.
Right. So for people who don't know, May 7th, 1915 is a date that will live in infamy in the First World War context because that was the date of the sinking of the Lusitania, a gigantic passenger liner, at one point, briefly, the largest passenger liner on the planet, that was sunk by German torpedo boats, submarines, just off the coast of Ireland, I believe. It was en route from New York to Liverpool. And as you would expect, it had something on the order of 128, I don't have the number, but over 100 American passengers on board, and was seen, of course, as a example of German perfidy. It was German was not a declared hostile belligerent against the United States at that time, but here they are killing over 100 American citizens on this passenger liner. This is a travesty. So it was one of the events that helped shape and prepare the public consciousness, the American public consciousness, for the entry of America into the First World War 2 years later. But on that very date, May 7th of 1915, that very morning, Colonel Edward Mandell House, which may be a name that's familiar to some, maybe not, but he was really the de facto president during the Wilson years. He was Wilson's handler, as he's often described. Wilson himself said, House is my independent self. He's my other personality. He thinks my thoughts, and was not hesitant to say that he consulted with House on everything. And House was essentially an agent for the bankers and financiers of Wall Street and London at the time. And he happened to be, Colonel Edward Mandell House, was in London on that day when the Lusitania was sunk, and he was talking first to Sir Edward Grey, who was at that time the Foreign Secretary of the British Foreign Office, and they fell to talking about the possibility that the Germans would sink a transatlantic passenger liner, and Grey asked House what would happen if such an event were to occur, and House told him, oh, well, a wave of indignation would sweep across America, and we would find ourselves quickly embroiled in the war. And later that very day, they're at Buckingham Palace talking to King George, and King George asks Colonel Edward Mandell House, who, by the way, was not a colonel, that's just an affectation that he adopted because it sounded nice, asked House about the possibility that, oh, I don't know, the Lusitania was sunk. And just a few hours later, lo and behold, the Lusitania was sunk. As I say in the documentary, that gives a window into the story of the Lusitania, which I could probably do an entire documentary just on the Lusitania incident itself. But the long story short is that the Lusitania was not an innocent passenger liner peace boat. It was carrying munitions. It was listed by the British Navy as an armed merchant cruiser. And it did go down in 18 minutes, which was incredibly fast, sunk to the bottom, because there was a secondary explosion, not the torpedo. It wasn't the torpedo that sunk it to the bottom. It was a secondary explosion, which, although it's impossible to prove these things at this point, but probably had something to do with the, 3 million, or was it 4 million rounds, 303 rounds in the cargo hold, along with gun cotton and other explosives and war material that were not listed on the passenger manifest and was officially denied by the British government for 99 years. It wasn't until 2014 that internal government documents, British government documents, were released that proved that, yes, they knew, of course, there was all this illegal material that was being shipped on board the Lusitania that day. And everyone knew it before that point, but it was interesting that it wasn't until 2014 that that officially came out from the official government documents. Anyway, again, the long story short on that is that that was one of the formative incidents that led to the American entry into World War One, and was part of what I call the World War One conspiracy, which was essentially a conspiracy to embroil the world in warfare. And that took place, first of all, in England. Going back, you could stretch it back to the 1890s to find the formation of the nucleus of the group that really was concertedly working towards putting the British Empire into war with Germany from the first decade of the 20th century onward. And that just transplanted basically overseas, over the Atlantic to America. Once the war was going in Europe, then the sights were set on America. So the part two of the documentary focuses really on how that clique conspired to bring about the American entry into World War One.
You know, it always amazes me. I mean, history shows us time and time again how these events come about, orchestrated by governments, by the leaders, like 9/11. And yet, like 9/11, people just have a hard time thinking that it would be done for personal agendas, and I don't know if personal agendas is the accurate way to describe it, but for, you know, to create and to begin wars and you know, what we've seen transpire since 9/11, people just refuse, or I don't know if they refuse, but they find it difficult to believe that 9/11 couldn't be an inside job. And yet, yes, time and time again through history, it's right there.
Exactly right. It's interesting to see the mental blocks that people put around these types of events. And there is a certain point, interestingly enough, where it's far enough into the history books that people can read it and just oh, yes, okay, there was a conspiracy to assassinate Julius Caesar. No one gets emotionally invested in that, and people can just see, oh, that's just history, and that's how that worked. And there's obvious motivations for people to conspire to do things like that, to kill people or to start wars. There's obvious motivations for that, and so it's not difficult for us to see that objectively when it's something hundreds or thousands of years in the past. But when it's something that's relatively recent and involves questioning the fundamental assumptions that people have about their own government and the legitimacy of that government and what it's willing to do in order... again, I shouldn't talk about the government as if it is a singular entity. We are talking about people who are within government and some without government that work in loosely knit groups. This isn't some comic book conspiracy where everyone meets around a table and plans the fate of the world, but there are loosely knit groups of people whose interests overlap at certain points, and one of those points was in the 1914 to 1917 period. There was a number of interests that overlapped with the idea of getting America into war. And some of that was essentially personal agendas. People personally profited from America's entry into World War I to the tune of ultimately billions of dollars. And in fact, one example that I point to in part three of the documentary, which I've just finished and will be released soon on my website, one of the people I talk about is Bernard Baruch, who was one of those Wall Street financiers who was wielding power in Washington at that time. Specifically, in fact, he was cited by the stepson of FDR in a book that he wrote, a very interesting book about his father. He mentioned Bernard Baruch as the man from Wall Street who was leading Wilson like a poodle on a string into Democratic Party headquarters back in 1912, back when they were basically assigning him to be the next president. They were just telling him what his agenda was going to be. You're going to pass the Federal Reserve Act, there's an income tax, et cetera, et cetera. So Bernard Baruch was apparently the man who was leading Wilson around at that time. And lo and behold, when the war started in 1917, or the American entry into the war in 1917, Bernard Baruch was appointed by Wilson to head something called the War Industries Board, which was this incredibly powerful body with command over every aspect of the American economy, the war economy. It could set quotas and production limits and prices and wage controls and all of that, and even standardized products themselves, all in the name of the war effort, of course. So it had incredible control over the economy, and as can be expected, and as was eventually discovered in congressional hearings that took place decades later, yes, the various industries involved in and organized under that War Industries Board were padding their costs so that they could profit from the war, to the tune ultimately of billions of dollars. It was said by this stepson of FDR, no source given, but it was at least alleged that Bernard Baruch himself personally profited to the tune of $200 million from being the head of that War Industries Board. $200 million, an unthinkable amount, even today, let alone in 1917, 1918. That's astronomical figures. So there's obvious reasons that various people would be involved in a conspiracy to bring something like that about. But again, people have those mental blocks. Oh, it couldn't have happened in our time, not with people that we know or could have voted for, or, you know, people that affect are thinking about our own government.
Well, you know, Dick Cheney, you know, Halliburton. You have a lot of other ones who've been accused of manufacturing evidence of weapons of mass destruction just to get the U.S. To invade Iraq. They were all students of World War I.
Yes, and the more things change, the more they remain the same. One of the interesting aspects that I took and from part two of that documentary and made into its own 6-minute self-contained clip that people can watch on my website called Babies on Bayonets was an example of the propaganda that was forwarded back in that time period, specifically surrounding the quote-unquote rape of Belgium, which was the way that the German invasion of Belgium in the early part of that war in 1914 was portrayed in the British press as a conduit, essentially, to propagandize the American public, again, to try to get America into the war. A lot of British press at the time was really forwarded and aimed at the American public to try to get them on board with this war. So the German invasion of Belgium became the rape of Belgium, and there were all these evocative images of babies being tossed about on bayonets by the German soldiers being crucified to the door of the church, nuns being raped, all of these incredible stories of just horrible atrocities that, in the end, yeah, most historians agree, yeah, most of that was kind of exaggerated and or completely made up out of whole cloth, and yeah, there was a lot of propaganda going around that just basically used these types of ideas for propaganda purposes and didn't really happen. Now, that's not to say there were no atrocities. This is a war, and there are horrible and despicable things done in war all the time, and Germany was no nation of angels, but they weren't these monstrous, devilish brutes either, and I think it's interesting that we see really exact parallels to our own times. We don't have to go back very far to see the babies being thrown from incubators story that helped spark the first Gulf War, which itself was completely fabricated, total nonsense. We now know that it was the work of a PR agency that was hired by the Kuwaiti government and was operating in Washington to spread that story. It was the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador that actually pretended to be a nurse that had seen these babies being thrown from incubators. We know that story was completely made up, but it's very similar to the babies on bayonet stories that were being bandied about a century ago. So if we don't learn from history, we are doomed to repeat it, unfortunately.
Well, you told you made a comment that you finished part three. Any teasers?
Yes. Part one, for those who haven't seen it yet, part one was about the formation of the clique in England and Britain that was steering basically the formation that led to the formation of the alliances that led to the outbreak of war in Europe in 1914. Part two is specifically about the America and how America was drawn into the war in 1917. Part three is really the big question, the most important question, even more important than the how, is the why. Really, why would anyone conceive of starting a world war and all of the incredible bloodshed that resulted from that? As you say, 9 million soldier deaths, 7 million civilians, just carnage on a scale the world had never before seen, and mechanized warfare of these machine guns and tanks and airplanes and just destruction that people couldn't have even imagined before the war broke out. Why would anyone unleash that? That's the real question, and there are a lot of answers, and I've touched on one of them. The profit motive is one part of that, but it's only a part of it.
I hate to say this, but did they do it because they could? Beside the profit, I mean, they got to this point where you just said the mechanics, the technology and so forth. They got to the point to where they could really unleash.
Yes, unfortunately, that's one of the sort of the logic of warfare, is that when you have these toys for big boys, as it were, for the military, they're going to want to use them, and we certainly see that happening these days, and that's part of what happens in every battle that that America and every other country really engages in, is, hey, it's a good testing ground for all our new toys that we've come up with in the meantime. So there is that aspect to it. I wouldn't say that's the driver. Ultimately, I'll give you this teaser. Part three is called A New World Order, and obviously, even the lines on the map that we know today, a lot of them do come from World War One, so I think the idea of shaping the world in the image of the victors is a very enticing notion for people throughout history.
So that agenda that they have is not a short term. I mean, they truly do plan for hundreds and hundreds of years for the future.
I think World War One still lives with us and is still very much a factor in the way the world is today.
Right. We're heading into a break right now, ladies and gentlemen. Please stay tuned. We'll be right back right after these few short messages.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey Light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188. And it's great to be here with James Corbett of the Corbett Report. Please make sure you get to the website and view his documentary on World War One. It's fascinating, and I can't wait to hear a little bit more about segment three. You know, we're talking about the New World Order, and 10 years after the last G20 summit in D.C., the world leaders are heading to Buenos Aires, Argentina, and they have selected the summit's theme, Building Consensus for Fair and Sustainable Development. You know, when I hear a sustainable development, I immediately think of Agenda 21, the UN, mm-hmm. and their 70 Sustainable Development Goals, the New World Order. Mm-hmm. Part of a wider 2030 agenda for their sustainable development. So, it's how is this all playing into, you know, what is this summit really all about? You know, we hear all the leaders, we hear mainly here in the States about Trump meeting with Putin and, you know, the trade agreement with, mm-hmm. you know, China, and, you know, you're really not getting anything much more than, is this an indication of just how far along or maybe not as far as they need to be for the Agenda 21 Sustainable Development, the UN and the New World Order?
Yeah, I think that might be the way of looking at that topic, especially the idea of building consensus on that, because that consensus, to the extent that it existed, or at least this seemed to be something that was developing, may have been derailed a bit in recent years by the Trump phenomenon and the trade wars generally. I venture to think, I'm not a fly on the wall there, but I'm betting that if I were, I would be hearing a lot of conversations about trade and very little about other international matters. So I think that idea, the trade wars and tariffs and all of this, may kind of have derailed that sustainable development push that was going on. And I think much the better for humanity, for people who don't know about Agenda 21 and Agenda 2030, whatever they're calling it this week, and the ideas there, which of course are always wrapped in the greatest platitudes about saving the earth and being, you know, sustainable and all of this, but in reality is manifested as essentially a monopolistic takeover of the resources of the world under the category of the the UN or some other international agency that will divvy up the spoils to those who are politically connected. If that sounds too cynical, I did do a podcast episode specifically called What is Sustainable Development, simply enough, where I talk about that in a great degree of detail and talk about some of the specific examples that we can look at where essentially there's a gigantic land grab that's going on, resource grab, and it's being put under this mantle of sustainable development. So I think it's interesting that they're trying to build the consensus on that, even as you say, most people are talking about Russia and Russia-U.S. relations and or trade wars, trade disputes. I think that's probably going to be the main focus of the leaders while they're there, more so than any sort of fluffy, flowery UN-related sustainable development rhetoric.
So do you think Trump really has made an impact on slowing down, for lack of better tag for him, the elite?
Yes. Well, yes.
And is it temporary? But is it temporary?
Well, that's the real crux of the issue. There's no doubt that the sort of smooth sailing towards globalism that we've seen over the past several decades has been, well, it's not so smooth anymore. And I don't know if completely derailed is the right way to say it, but certainly there have been kinks thrown into that make it difficult to imagine that things will progress as before. But the question, as always, is will the powers that shouldn't be, as it were, use this as an opportunity to fail forward? And sometimes it's through cataclysm or perceived cataclysm or chaos of some sort that they attempt to bring about even more of their own personal brand of solution, which is a type of order based on all of the globalist principles that they've been aiming at. So one example that you can think of in that regard would be something like the European Union. It's falling apart. You've got these populist regimes rising. You have unrest. You have people talking about leaving the EU. You have the Brexit phenomenon. Well, the EU may just use all of that as an excuse to fail forward, as it were, and now they're talking about forming their super army and joint borders and all of this. So the possibility is that, yes, Trump may be this kind of, may be a giant wrecking ball in the sort of globalist status quo, but how do they rebuild that when that wrecking ball is removed? And, you know, whether there's some impeachment or whatever that process may be, or maybe Trump just leaves office. I mean, in 2 years or in 6 years, whatever. At some point, Trump will leave office, and it's very possible that things will go back to as they were before, or maybe they might even use this as an opportunity to say, look, the global economy was proceeding on a smooth pace, everything was going fine, and then this Trump tariff and trade wars and all this chaos started, and now look, now there are economic projections are for decreasing global growth over the next few years. How do we mend that? Oh, we have to restore faith in the international order and blah, blah, blah. One can imagine that kind of narrative. So it's not as simple as saying, oh, it's been disabled, it's been derailed, it's been dismantled. The real question is what comes along in the wake of this chaos.
Well, General Motors came out this week and they announced that they were laying off 14,000 plus laborers. They're going to close factories, and President Trump came out the next day. And it's, I mean, you know, we can't go back and talk about the bailout that they received and so forth. And so it's, you know, back and forth, and also with the promise of tariffs on foreign vehicles. And I'm leading this into Nissan and the scandal that has occurred within that corporation, and how, if you can combine, you know, nice, give us some information on the Nissan scandal, which just doesn't get any press over here at all, very little, and how the tariffs on foreign vehicles would affect Japan.
Yes. Well, on the first point, I think there would obviously, if there was a 25% import tariff placed on automobiles, obviously the Japanese car market would very much feel the effects of that, because, of course, Japan is a huge exporter of cars to the American market. And I've heard it said, I believe Honda manufactures more cars in America than in Japan, or sells more cars in America than in Japan, which may be true. I don't have the numbers in front of me. But anyway, of course, Japanese car makers are heavily reliant on their exports to America. So a 25% tariff would be a significant blow to Japanese car makers, which is why it's of a special interest to Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. And he did apparently talk about that with Trump in September during a summit, at which time Trump apparently promised that there would be no additional duties, at least while trade talks were in progress. But now we're talking about 25% tariffs. Who knows? Again, this is all coming from presidential tweets and things, so we'll have to see how that develops. But it could be of particular interest, as you say, to Nissan, because, as people may or may not have heard, the chairman of Nissan, Carlos Ghosn, was arrested in Japan last week relating to some reporting irregularities, shall we say, on his personal books. And now we're starting to get drips and drabs of information. The latest is that apparently Carlos Ghosn, the chair of Nissan Motors, apparently it was accepting $80 million in essentially IOUs from Nissan as sort of deferred payment compensation from the company as a way of basically underreporting his actual earnings. Essentially, this is payment, but we'll pay you later so that you don't have to report it now, kind of thing. And apparently his legal defense is essentially, well, I thought it was legal. I was told this was all legal. So we'll have to see what happens. But of course, the Japanese justice system is quite infamous for its exceptionally high prosecution rate. Almost everyone who gets charged with a crime gets convicted. So it will be very interesting to see what happens to Carlos Ghosn. Even more interesting, I suppose, to see what happens to Nissan generally, because one would expect that something of this magnitude, the chair of Nissan getting arrested, would have a significant effect on the stock. And as expected, the stock did plunge 6% on the day that this news broke last week. But it immediately started gaining back a lot of that loss. And at this point, it's only down slightly from where it was, which has frustrated a lot of the hedge funds, which immediately started shorting Nissan to the tune of up to 15% of its stock price, anticipating that, you know, this would be a major blow to Nissan shares. But apparently not yet, at any rate. Maybe the markets are waiting for actual conviction, or maybe some analysts are saying, well, actually, it's just that a lot of institutional investors have steered clear of Nissan for a long time anyway, because corporate governance problems and the like. So perhaps there just hasn't been enough interest, so that there aren't that many people who are interested. I'm not sure what the exact reasons are for this, but it's not exactly intuitive. But it's a fascinating story anyway.
Well, maybe it's computer trading that's keeping it from making any of those big drops. And
one never knows.
And you did a recent article about the SEC launches a database to prevent another flash crash. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's something similar. You stated in your article that playing in the manipulated and rigged stock market is not for the faint of heart. Things can turn on a dime. And that surefire stock you're writing today might just revert to its intrinsic value, zero, tomorrow. So maybe that was something with the Nissan stock that
That might have accounted for the lack of precipitous crash. Yeah, well, I mean, one never knows what's exactly going on in the back door of these markets, and that was the point of that article where I was talking about, of course, the May 6, 2010 flash crash that saw the Dow lose 1,000 points in the span of 35 minutes and then gain most of it back. It was just an incredible day, and it was obviously this was related to some sort of algorithmic conniption fit that was taking place. The bots went crazy that day on the stock market for some reason, and it was swept under the rug fairly quickly. Oh, okay, well, we're looking into it. Don't worry, there's an SEC investigation. And as I reported a couple of years ago, the DOJ did eventually come back and basically throw a scapegoat in jail for the flash crash. Oh, it was all due to this guy who was trading out of his parents' basement, basically. And that was the bow that was supposed to go on that story. But the next stage of that is the SEC then created a new rule regarding a consolidated audit trail, because of course there's all these different markets within the national market system for national securities in the U.S., and they all have their own reporting, and they all collect different data in different ways. And the SEC was saying, look, this is a nightmare for us to try to be regulators and oversee all of this. So they wanted a consolidated audit trail, which would be the holy grail of, here's this database. Every single market participating in this national market system will have to send its data in real time, and it will have to contain all of this information. So standardizing everything so that it could all be watched over by the virtuous angels at the Securities and Exchange Commission that was founded and or started by a bootlegger back in the, you know, Kennedy days. This was going to solve all the problems, except for the fact that the database that the SEC has created and actually launched, it is, I guess, all green lights. It started last week, is a bit glitchy. And by a glitch, I mean basically unusable. There's a problem with it apparently stemming from certain option trades that can't always be tied to the underlying orders that make up the transaction, which of course is the whole point of this consolidated audit trail. So it's a bit more than a minor glitch. But my point in that essay was really to go over not only that glitch, but even assuming that the SEC can get things working properly with that database, it's not going to address the root of the problem, which goes to the SEC itself, which cannot be trusted to run such a scheme fairly, because I point out, for example, as one whistleblower, Richard Grove, pointed out with regards to the SEC several years ago, he knew of a backdoor in the software that was being marketed to comply with the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, the new things that came in after the WorldCom Enron scandal back in the early 2000-2001 period. We had the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, and which required new reporting. So there was this new software that was being marketed. Don't worry, guys, you buy this software, you'll be compliant. And this whistleblower found, wait, this software has a back door that specifically allows you to put transactions in that disappear so they'll never be seen again. And he went to the SEC with that. The SEC not only refused to act on that information, they went and bought that very same compliance software with the backdoor for themselves, which should give you a window into the situation. And also, of course, the root of the flash crash problem was not that the SEC wasn't watching over every transaction in the markets. The root was the algorithmic trading, and this isn't going to solve that problem either.
Isn't the system just too big? I mean, to monitor, I mean, hasn't they created a mind of its own to some degree? I mean, or is it not as large as what I believe it is to be? I mean, is anybody controlling it?
Is anybody in control is really a good question. And, the fact that we're relying on algorithmic trading that no human could possibly react that quickly is worrying, because then you are relying on the programmers of those algorithms to be basically gods themselves, to be completely able to understand the entire market, and that's just not realistic.
Well, I'm sorry, James, but we're out of time. I'd love to be here much, much longer, but ladies and gentlemen, that's it for today. So until then, be safe, good night, and God bless. Thank you, James.
Thank you.